Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
This is Classical Ideas with Greg Soden. Welcome to Classical Ideas. This is Greg Soden. The history of Islam in the United States is much more interesting than many people can imagine. And I'm delighted today to bring you this conversation with Dr. Sylvia Chan Malik to discuss her new book, Being Muslim, A Cultural History of Women of Color in American Islam. The stories in this book are quite incredible, powerful, empowering, and a real delight to read. This is a topic I was new to studying, and this conversation with Sylvia Chan Malik was a real treat. So, Dr. Sylvia Chan Malik is Associate Professor in the Departments of American and Women's and Gender Studies at Rutgers University, New Brunswick. She talks, teaches, and writes about the intersections of race, gender, and religion, with a focus on the history and cultures of Islam and Muslims in the United States. Her research highlights the lives, voices, histories, and representations of Muslim women and reveals how critical legacies of Black freedom, women's agency, and global liberation struggles have continually marked U.S. Muslim women's engagements with Islam. She is the author of Being Muslim, A Cultural History of Women of Color in American Islam from New York University Press in 2018. Her writings are also featured in the anthologies With Stones in Our Hands, Writings on Muslims, Racism, and Empire, The Rutledge Handbook of Islam in the West, and The Cambridge Companion to Religion of American Islam, and multiple academic journals. At Rutgers, she teaches courses on race and ethnicity in the United States, Islam in and America, social justice movements, feminist methodologies, multi-ethnic literature and culture in the U.S., and contemporary U.S. history. Our conversation today focuses deeply on the research of being Muslim, but we had a great time and left many possible topics untouched. I imagine that Dr. Chan Malik will be back on the show at some point. Thank you to New York University Press for making this episode possible. So without further delay, here is my conversation with Dr. Sylvia Chan Malik from Rutgers University. Dr. Sylvia Chan Malik, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Can you start off by introducing yourself briefly to the audience?
Sure. So my name, as you just said, is Sylvia Chan Malik. I am an associate professor of American Studies and Women's and Gender Studies at Rutgers University in New Brunswick. I teach courses on Islam in America, race and ethnicity in the United States, social justice movements in the U.S. and beyond, and feminist theory and methodologies here at Rutgers. And I love teaching, and I love talking about my work, so I'm really happy to be here today.
Fantastic. What is the focus of your PhD, if I may ask?
I received my PhD from the University of California, Berkeley, in a department called Ethnic Studies. And a lot of times I tell people that and they go, ethics? And it's actually quite, it's not ethics, though, you know, ethical engagement is involved in that field. Ethnic studies is the study of comparative race and ethnicity. Ethnic studies is the study of comparative race and ethnicity in the United States and beyond. That department at UC Berkeley and also at San Francisco State University grew out of the third world and civil rights struggles of the 1960s and 70s, in which people started asking for history and political science and literature classes that actually reflected, you know, the communities that were attending those colleges and were in those areas. And so ethnic studies, you know, looks at alternative histories, alternative voices, and they have a vibrant and thriving undergraduate and graduate program there.
Excellent. You know, what's really interesting is that the reason we're talking today is because of your brand new book, Being Muslim, A Cultural History of Women of Color in American Islam. And what you just said is interesting to me because you didn't do a PhD in religious studies.
No, I did not.
So
that's an interesting engagement for me.
I'd love to know a little bit more about how you approach your work a little bit maybe differently than a religious studies professor before we dive into the book.
Absolutely. I mean, that's a great question. I think about that a lot myself because I didn't really set out to write a religious studies book. I mean, in all honesty, because I didn't quite know what that was. You know, I hadn't been trained in religious studies fields. I had not, you know, engaged in a lot of formal training around religion. And I definitely knew I was not a theologian or someone who worked with religious texts or interpreted religious texts. What I was interested in, and we'll talk a little bit more about it in a minute, was how do you tell a history of Islam and Muslims in the United States? And as I said, my PhD was in ethnic studies. And so the way in which I approached that was to think about how do we find the voices and the lives of actual Muslims in the United States? And how do we kind of figure out how they live their lives as Muslims? And so my approach was more as a historian, as someone, you know, who engages with literature and media, and as an ethnographer, you know, someone doing interviews and trying to find oral histories and things, and trying to see what people themselves said about their religious identities, which I think is quite different from a religious studies training, where you are kind of looking at that relationship between text and lived experience, but a lot of times mostly focusing on text and the kind of historical forms of interpretation that have come out of engaging religious texts. So I have a far more, I think, historically grounded approach to my subject matter. So I think it's produced something slightly different than some, you know, what someone trained in religious studies might have done. And it's really interesting to hear, you know, the exchange. It's been really fun for me.
I love it. So I got this book from NYU Press, and it came out very, very recently. And the title, Being Muslim, A Cultural History of Women of Color in American Islam. And I want to start talking about the book backwards, sort of. And
sure.
I want to talk about the conclusion chapter of your book, which I found to be really compelling because it's so personal to your own life. And in that conclusion chapter, you talk about the lives in Islam of two converts, one of which is you and one of which is your friend Maya, who runs a farm in California. So I'm curious about your conversion experience. So to situate yourself within the stories the book tells of women of color in American Islam, can you tell me a little bit about your background to your spiritual life prior to 2004?
Sure. And I love the fact that you're starting with the end, because that conclusion of the book, kind of thinking about the intersection of spirituality and engagement with land and environmental crisis, that's kind of where I am right now. That's very much where my heart, you know, and my work and my research is going toward. So it's a great place to start for me.
Excellent. That's great.
And so I intentionally did not reveal my own engagement with Islam as a spiritual practice until the final chapter of the book, because it was very intentional on my part, because I did not want that to be, I didn't want myself in any way to be the focus of these amazing women's stories that I try to highlight and talk about throughout the book. I reserved it for the epilogue because I, at the same time that I didn't want to be a focal point of the book, I also didn't think it was an insignificant point to reveal about my subjectivity. I don't think there's any such thing as neutral scholarship or neutral research. I think we're all grounded in our own subjectivities, our own lives, our own family backgrounds, you know, all those things. So when I decided to include that information at the end, it was a kind of nod to saying that not only have I engaged these women, I've actually also, you know, perhaps not had the same sensations and feelings and experiences that they have, but I've had a glimpse, you know, sort of like, you know, what an anthropologist might call, you know, a deep ethnography, right? You know, my lived experiences have touched upon those of the women I think about and write about in the book. In regards to my own spiritual background, it's interesting. I grew up in an immigrant Chinese household in the Bay Area, very diverse, very, in many ways, I guess you would say, left-leaning progressive community in California, very large East Asian population. I grew up with lots of Chinese Americans who were mostly culturally Buddhist, but not really practicing that much. And from a very young age, I had a very strong attraction and just fascination with religion. I was fascinated with my friends who were Catholic, who had, you know, first communions. I always wished I could do that. And I, you know, my parents were, you know, just not really into that. They were, you know, they were like, oh, you go to school, we have Chinese New Year, we do these things. But I could never kind of, you know, it always fascinated me, kind of the ritual and the circumstance, you know, of all of my friends who went to church and did these things. As I got older, I kind of participated, you know, at one point. I almost was baptized in the Christian church. I had, you know, many close friends who were Jewish in college and got very interested in that. But for some reason, and again, we can talk about it when we talk about how the research from the book came from. When I started doing research into Islam and Muslims in the United States, and this was in the direct aftermath of 9/11 when I started doing this work, for some reason, the teachings and just the simplicity of Islam as a religion made sense to me. Certain kind of things that I had been drawn to and attracted to in lots of other faiths. But, you know, kind of you drift away. They told your interest. You move away from them. Something about the simplicity of Islam held me. And so I stuck with it as a scholar, and kind of kept thinking and engaging the text. And I very much think about my life, my lived experience, and my research and everything sort of being a very serendipitous trajectory where everything converged and came together in certain ways. And I should mention also in the course of doing my research, I met my, you know, now husband. And we've been together, you know, for 17 years now.
Yeah.
And he's, you know, from a Muslim family, from a Muslim background. And so it was, you know, I kind of had to, I had to respond to the ways in which my life was, you know, kind of teaching me how to be. So it all comes together, I think, in my work and, you know, what I try to do with this book and what I hope it will do in the world.
How would you say your life is the most different post-conversion as opposed to your life pre-conversion?
You know, I was thinking about that question, and It's difficult to answer because in a lot of ways, I would say I have no idea because, I feel like so much of who I am, the core of who I am is essentially the same. I care about the same types of things. I do the type of work I do. I'm drawn to religious faith and the divine and understanding, all of these concepts because of my deep desire for justice and equality and, an interest in what love really is. And that was what I was drawn to in Islam as well, these concepts. But I guess if I were to say a difference is because, as I said, both my research and my own personal engagement with Islam took place after 9/11, it was this very deep awareness of the ways in which Islam and Muslims were so incredibly misrepresented and demonized and misunderstood in most cultural and political discourses, and then kind of understanding that what I'm learning about this religion and how I'm engaging it is so utterly different from how it's being perceived and talked about
Yeah. And
by so many people.
As I was reading the book, I wrote misrepresented in the media or in the world in the margins of the book so many times.
Right, and absolutely. So I think one thing that's changed, and I guess, there's more things, like I've changed my diet a little, I don't eat pork, those are kind of, very basic things. But and I'm the and I don't know if you have images of people, accompanying your podcast, but I'm a Chinese American woman. I'm born and raised in the United States. I don't cover my hair. I am not someone that you would recognize as a Muslim walking down the street, and I'm, for the most part, don't have to deal with a lot of the negativity that my friends, my relatives, people I care about a lot have to deal with because of that. I'm, relatively privileged in that way. And so, beyond that, I would say that it's just something I carry in my body, like how I understand the ways in which you have to orient yourself towards the world in a certain way. And I think that actually comes across in the book. That's what I'm trying to say, because I've felt that myself, that you have to engage the world through a particular understanding that what you are actually living and what you experience and what is an integral part of your identity is completely, not what most people perceive you to be.
So there are so many amazing stories that you are telling in the book, and so many profiles of women whose stories are very overlooked. Like, a lot of these are brand new stories to me, and I'm 35 years old. So the book's subtitle is interesting to me: A Cultural History of Women of Color in American Islam. So as a woman, an academic, and a convert to Islam, what were some of your guiding motivations for seeking to tell the stories of the four American Muslim ladies, the Nation of Islam seekers in the Cold War, Betty Shabazz, Dakota Staton, the women in the 1979 Iran Revolution, post 9/11 America? Like, what was your guiding motivation for telling these stories?
That's another great question. So the term women of color, a lot of people have asked me about that. Why did you choose that particular, wording to describe the women in your book? A lot of people have pointed out, so much of your book is about African American women and African American Muslims. And the first thing I usually say in response to that is that I wanted to write a history of Muslims and Islam in the United States. Right. And so prior and Islam and Muslim women in the United States. And so prior to the 1970s or so, the vast majority of Muslims who were in the United States, and if you were to encounter a Muslim in the United States who would say they were Muslim and present themselves as Muslim and identify as such, they were very likely or most likely to be African American. They were most likely to be someone who had come to Islam and engaged Islam through conversion, right, at that time. And so because of that historical record, right, and the types of, people who very publicly identified as Muslim, I tried to follow that. Because I, at the same time that I'm interested in women's inner lives and their construction of their Muslimness, as I call it, their Muslim identity, I was also interested in the ways Islam and Muslim women were being portrayed at different moments in time. So they had to be public, public representations, right? So a photograph. Like I start in the first chapter with a photograph of four Muslim women together, and then I move on to images of the women in the Nation of Islam, and then Betty Shabazz, who's the wife and then widow of Malcolm X, and a jazz singer named Dakota Staton, right? So I tried to look at women in which I could query their internal lives and personal lives, but also look at the ways in which they were being portrayed. Because the central contention of the book is that the ways in which women were expressing their identities as Muslims happened against political backdrops in which categories of race, gender, class, and citizenship were shifting and are always contested, right, in politics and culture.
Excellent. So I want you to kind of like try to think back to the very, very beginning of this process when you were thinking about these ideas before you'd ever written a word of the book or found a single piece of research in any archive. Mm-hmm. What question did you ask yourself that eventually bloomed into this piece of work that's sitting on my desk next to me?
I started graduate school, as I said, 2 weeks before the events of 9/11. And I went into graduate school with absolutely no idea that I was going to write a book about Muslims, that I was going to do research on Islam in the United States. You know, I had no idea what my life and my research or anything would become. And what I was interested in at the time, you know, before I started writing the book, like you said, before a word had emerged at all, was I had been very involved with activism and community engagement around African American and Asian American community interactions. And this was because growing up, you know, in the going to high school in the early 1990s and then college in the 90s, I was very invested in what was happening in the post-LA riots, mm-hmm. the post-LA uprising era, and thinking about how different communities of color, African-American, Latino, Asian-American, could try to find connection within the communities in which they lived. I was also working in the West Oakland Public Schools at the time, you know, and trying to think about ways in which different communities could come together and have conversations. And so my question at that time was, how do we bridge, you know, these misunderstandings and these types of antagonisms between different communities that are living side by side, you know, Black and Korean communities, you know, Black and Latino communities, different communities. That was what I went into wanting to do. You know, trying to work in the community and do advocacy and think about those questions. So that really animated the book because what happened was after 9/11, you know, as someone who had always done activism and organizing and advocacy, myself and many of my peers jumped into high gear around sort of organizing, consciousness raising and peace walks and things like that. Around the Muslim community in the Bay Area, because they were immediately kind of subjected to all sorts of attacks at that time that were happening. People were, you know, people were scared. People were reacting. And, you know, knowing about histories of Japanese internment and things like that, was there's a sizable population of former Japanese internees at that time. We were, you know, there were connections going on there where former Japanese internees and their children and their grandchildren were reaching out to Muslims as well. Mm. You know, talking about how they needed to kind of come together. So I was trying to facilitate those conversations or working with them, working with those communities. I remember we did kind of peace marches around the lake in Oakland and all these types of things.
Go ahead.
No, and so as that kind of happened, what I came to see is that as a religious community, and this is where, you know, my lack of training in religious studies kind of, you know, really came to the fore. I was like, oh, but this is a religious community. And so in this community, in the Muslim community, just in the San Francisco Bay Area, there were Yemeni shopkeepers, there were African Americans, there were, you know, South Asian doctors and lawyers, and, you know, there was all these different types of Muslims. And even they themselves hadn't had a lot of conversations amongst themselves about how to be Muslims together, right?
Right.
And so that was when I said, oh, this training that I have, or this, you know, work that I've done around different racial and ethnic communities is actually useful in trying to engage the Muslim community. And so that was the lens I brought to that.
That reminds me of that. That really segues nicely to a question I was thinking about. So your past interest in activism and studying of race and ethnicity and justice comes out really clearly in the stories that you tell in the book, which I think is going to be a really mind-expanding and world-expanding view of Muslims in America. So on page 17, you write, quote, "The notion that Islam itself holds the potential for women's liberation has been central to women's way of being Muslim in America, particularly for Black American Muslim women and subsequently other women of color." So that to me is such a cool line. So
thank you.
How is and that sort of comes from a scholar named Sherman Jackson. So how is American Islam for women almost like a form of American, like, liberation theology? Like, would you call it that as well?
In a way, yeah. I mean, it definitely has to do with the notion of liberation, you know, from a moment in history that even precedes, you know, when that term emerges, like in the 1960s, right? So absolutely. I do think that Islam in the United States is always linked to histories of struggle and the desire for liberation, and in a particular register for women, Black women. So yes, I would agree with that. And there's a reason for that, right?
Yeah.
And so the way I talk about it in the book, or, you know, the way Islam appears in African American communities in the early 20th century is in the midst of this moment of the emergence of Black nationalism and Pan-Africanism, right? Within, in many cases, a newly enfranchised Black population in the United States, right? And so quick, you know, I always feel like it's really important to include the fact that anywhere from 1/5 to 1/3 of enslaved Africans to the United States and the Americas more broadly were Muslim.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's absolutely been kind of tracked, and there's more and more scholarship coming out on that the vast majority of, you know, many of the enslaved peoples that were brought here came from a region of West Africa, which is now Senegal and the Gambia, right? And these were and continue to be predominantly Muslim countries. So historians have estimated, like I said, that anywhere from 1/5 to 1/3 of the enslaved peoples brought here were Muslim. And in many cases, they continued to try to practice Islam, right, to do their daily prayers, to fast during Ramadan, to abstain from eating pork, or, you know, to have a certain type of diet when they were here. But due to, you know, the violence and horrors of slavery, of forced conversion, these types of things, many were unable to do so. And of course, unable to build houses of worship or have kind of institutional structures in which they could be Muslim. Right. So by the end of the 19th century or so, most of these formal practices of Islam had been, you know, for the most part, wiped out or stifled. right, amongst the Black population. Mm. And lived on in particular ways, though. I mean, you have descendants of formerly enslaved peoples, for example, at Saplo Island in Georgia. There's a whole population there that are the descendants of an enslaved man named Bilali, who was a his life is documented in the history books. And he was someone who could read Quran, he could read Arabic, and he had, I believe, 17 children, and his descendants still live on that island. And many of them said, oh, we don't practice Islam per se, but in our family, we have never put pork fat in the food. We always use turkey grease or something instead. Or we always washed our hands a certain way before we ate dinner. Or, you know, we always pray in this direction. You know what I mean? So there are these cultural practices that still live on.
Excellent. Right? And you know, what's so cool about that too is say you come from that family and you start doing a little bit of research as you get older and you realize that, oh, this is why we're doing all of it.
Exactly.
And then you would be drawn back to the practices of more formal study and practice of Islam as well.
Right. Right. And so I mean, I say that all as a preface to talk about the ways in which Islam already existed in the U.S. as a type of presence. Like, even if it wasn't a formal religious practice, it lived on in these embodied ways, in these cultural expressions amongst, you know, a great number of people, formerly enslaved and then later enfranchised African Americans. So in the early 20th century, the way in which Islam emerges is that after the Great Migration North, right, in which after the passage of the 13th Amendment, so many formerly enslaved peoples from the South, you know, all over the start going north, right, in huge numbers. They go to places like Chicago, they go to Detroit, they go to New York, Philadelphia, Newark, New Jersey, right, all these places. And when they get there, you know, they're very working class. They're coming straight from the farm or the plantation, right? And what do people do when they get to a new place? They seek out communities. And for this population, what was central to finding community was religious connection. However, in a lot of those northern towns, there were already established Black churches. Many of them were very middle class and upper class. For example, in Chicago, there was an established Black bourgeoisie, right? So if you can imagine kind of formerly enslaved peoples who came from the plantation having very different cultural, you know, norms and things like that, many of them didn't feel accepted in a lot of these middle class churches and things like that. So they started trying to find alternative spaces to practice religion. So also in this moment, because you have this massive movement of formerly enslaved peoples to the north, right, you also have movements for Black liberation that are arising. So someone like Marcus Garvey, who's preaching this political rhetoric of pan-Africanism, that, you know, African peoples worldwide must come together and rise up together and create their own institutions and structures, right? And in this discourse of Pan-Africanism, there are different thinkers, Garvey himself, but also people like Edward Wilmot Blyden, a Black philosopher and theorist and theologian at that time, saying that Christianity is part of the problem of why African Americans are being dehumanized, you know, and disenfranchised. Christianity has been part of the problem. So Black people, both in the U.S. and beyond, have to find alternative spiritualities, right?
Yeah.
And so Islam arises in that moment as a clear alternative, right? That this is a better religion. This is actually, you know, kind of thinking about the fact that there are so many Muslims in Africa, right? People, these leaders are saying Islam is a much more suitable religion for Black Americans. We can actually find strength. We can critique Christianity. It's liberating.
My goodness. Right? Okay. So, and out of all of those time periods and movements comes like communities and new buildings that arise and newsletters and magazines. Can we talk a little bit about some of your research?
Sure, absolutely.
My favorite thing about the book is, and I know this is going to sound unacademic of me, but it's these amazing images that you have in the text, because I feel like I could just look at these images, and it's almost like this a fantastic photo album surrounded by scholarship. So I want to know a little bit about some of these newsletters and newspapers and journals that you found, notably Muslim Sunrise, Messenger, mm-hmm. and Jet. Tell me about these publications that were, I mean, were they popular? Like, what were these about, and how did you go about working with them for the book?
Right, so those three different publications are different types of publications that circulated in kind of different spaces and for vastly kind of varying readerships. So the Muslim Sunrise was a publication of the Ahmadiyya movement in Islam, which was an early South Asia-based missionary movement that was one of the first Islamic groups to convert African Americans to Islam in very large numbers, right? So this is in the early 1920s. And so they were a very, like I said, they were a missionary-based group. So they were very actively proselytizing, at first in all communities, right? But immediately, their central missionary, Mufti Muhammad Sadiq, realized that Islam's message of egalitarian kind of racial brotherhood and sisterhood, and that everyone was equal in the eyes of God, it was very appealing to Black Americans. And he actually went, Mufti Muhammad Sadiq, actually went to Garveyite meetings, you know, meetings in which political orators and things were espousing Black nationalism and Pan-Africanism. And so Mufti Muhammad Sadiq, who was the first missionary of the Ahmadiyya movement in Islam, decided, you know, very early on that he needed to have copious amounts of literature to share with potential converts, right? So immediately upon coming to the United States, he started this newsletter called the Muslim Sunrise. And it was supposed to be a bi-monthly newsletter, I think one issue every 2 months, in which he sort of, you know, put in some basic teachings about Islam. But there are also a lot of other, you know, and he would have news items about Muslims around the world and things that were happening, but also these really interesting tracks about how, you know, Islam was the solution to the race problem in the United States and things like that. And kind of talking about what he saw as, faults in Christianity, right? Yeah. So all these things were in this newsletter that he circulated. But there was also things like conversion rolls. You know, everyone who converted had their name listed in the Muslim Sunrise. And so that newsletter, I don't know actually what the publication count was, but it is available now largely because the organization, the Ahmadiyya Movement in Islam, which still exists and, you know, has a very strong presence in the United States, has archived all of the issues, and they are available online back to the very first issue that came out, I believe, in 1922.
Amazing.
So you can look online and find them yourself and look at a lot of the original issues yourself.
Nice.
For that one.
Part of being an academic is the thrill of research and finding something that has been underexamined or overlooked in history. What were some of the happiest discoveries that you made while you were researching? Like, what got you jumping for joy, like out of your chair, because you found something that was really fantastic and incredible for this book?
I absolutely loved doing the research for my first chapter, in which I look at this photograph that was in the Muslim Sunrise of these four African American women. And they're just, you know, they just have their names. They have names like Florence Watts, or, you know, names that are not incredibly, I guess, I mean, they are special. Everybody's name is special, but You know, they're fairly, you know, like if you Google Florence Watts or something like that, you're not going to find a lot, right?
Yeah.
The working class women, there are these four women that I find. And this picture has kind of circulated, not a lot, but somewhat amongst scholars of American Islam or, you know, scholars of U.S. history at that time, as just sort of an example of Muslims existing. And so as I kind of dug deeper, I realized that I was able to track one of those women, Florence Watts, Sister Zainab, she's called in that photo. After she converts, she takes the name Zainab. I was actually able to track her going through census records and finding work records and actually finding her address.
Incredible.
Finding where she worked. So I was able to find, she was the only one of those four women that I was able to find. And so kind of from doing that, I actually figured out like, oh, she lived two blocks from where that first mosque was on the south side of Chicago. I actually went there to that neighborhood and kind of saw how close that address was to where the mosque was. And I was able from that to piece together her life, which was so exciting because, you know, to try to find the life or try to find the story of a working class African American woman who converts to Islam in 1922 is not easy.
It's astonishing.
Yeah, so when I was able to actually track her and then kind of pull all the pieces together, I had a big map on my wall where I had like, oh, she walked from here to here, and this is where the store was, and this is where this was. I was ecstatic. Like, it was really fun to do that, and just really thrilling to see the ways in which this was a real person, and she really lived, and these were the places she walked.
Did you find the mosque or the building where that photograph was taken by any chance?
The mosque is still there.
Okay.
The mosque is still there. Al-Sadiq Mosque on the south side of or in the Bronzeville district of Chicago. It's been completely rebuilt, right? I mean, because it's a very old building, but it's still there on that corner right there on Wabash Avenue in Chicago.
And I found that you wrote an article, a short article from a website called, what is it, Sapelo?
Sapelo.
Sapelo.
It's named after that island in Georgia that I mentioned.
Oh, okay.
Bilali Muhammad lived and his descendants still live.
And you have an article with this picture on that website so that people can find it as well, because it's so worth looking at. I mean, it's mesmerizing. I could just look at it for a long time.
Yeah, and that's, people actually say that about that picture. And it's really interesting just because you start to think, like, what are they wearing?
Exactly.
They're wearing their church clothes and hats, but then they have these sheets draped over them. And it's very fascinating to think, you know, why did they do that? How did they come to think Muslim women look like that? You know, what was their intention? And so those were the types of questions I started off asking when I saw the picture myself.
Another story that really drew me in was the incredible story of the Iranian Revolution and women in Iran. And that story seems kind of overlooked these days. Why does the rise of the Ayatollah Khomeini matter in the story of the veil in Islam, which is such a, you know, a topic that is so heavily discussed today?
I think that moment in March 1979, or just the engagements with the U.S. And Iran in 1979, are so critical to understanding where we are right now and how we talk about Islam and Muslims. And so while most Americans, I mean, the time passes so quickly, so every year I have more and more students in my class that have never heard of these things, and that's okay. But the 1979 hostage crisis is something that most people are familiar with, right?
Mm-hmm.
Hostage crisis, there was a movie, I guess, about it. Ben Affleck made that movie Argo about it a few years ago. So most people know about that. But 9 months prior to that, there was a women's revolution in Iran. And what happened was the Ayatollah Khomeini, who had come to power in Iran largely with the support of young, you know, in large part liberal and secular Iranians, right? He had come to power with their support because they were rebelling against the regime of the Shah. Shah Reza Pahlavi, who had been, for the most part, installed by the U.S. government in the 1950s. as a proxy kind of, or as a presence to advance certain types of values in oil politics in the region, right? So again, that's another sort of, you know, thing that people might go, whoa, really? The Ayatollah was actually brought into power by young, liberal, and, you know, in a large part, secular Iranians, right, who wanted an end to this regime of this monarch, right, or this, you know, what they saw as this, you know, U.S. installed ruler, right, who had imposed secularism on Iran. So what happened was, after the Ayatollah came to power with the support of all these young, liberal, educated Iranians, one of the things he did after he came to power was issue an edict that Iranian women who were working in government jobs had to wear the full head covering and robe called the chador, the black, you know, kind of what we sort of see as this symbol of fundamentalist Islam, this mm-hmm. black robe. And he instituted this policy. And from there, what happened was, you can imagine these young, in large part educated, Western-influenced Iranian women who had supported the Ayatollah felt incredibly betrayed, right? Because they said, oh, we supported you, and now you are, you know, telling us how to dress. Like, you didn't say you were going to do that. So out of that came these week of protests and revolts that women embarked upon in Iran in March. And this is a moment in which, at the height of the feminist movement in the United States, the U.S. press covers the heck out of this week in Iran, right? Every day, if you look at the newspapers at that time, they're talking about, oh, the women are revolting in the streets against this tyrannical cleric, the Ayatollah, you know, kind of with no context or background of the fact that they were actually the ones who brought him power, but now they were just angry at the way he had turned their backs on them or betrayed them. But within, so why I argue that it's important is that in this moment in which the United States is finally, in a certain way, you know, in the mainstream and a cultural way, embracing feminism as something that, quote unquote, we as Americans support, right? It's using that idea that we Americans are this feminist nation, right, to talk about how backwards Iran is and these Muslims are, because they're making their women wear this veil. And so you see that in the media coverage every day. And this is the first moment you see in the United States in which the veil and the seeming misogyny of Islam and its connection to fundamentalist Islam really becomes this full-blown idea in the American press.
Hmm.
And of course, we see that to this day.
Yeah. Right? So it seems like second wave American white feminists used Middle Eastern women as a prop to express distaste for a government.
Right, absolutely. I mean, and you see, like, so in that chapter, I look at these very specific ways, like Kate Millett, who's a very prominent American feminist at that time, actually goes to Tehran and says she's protesting in solidarity with the women there. And she calls the Ayatollah Khomeini a sexist pig. And she's taking this language that U.S. feminists, you know, white second wave feminists are using to talk about, you know, sexism in the United States, and just wholesale applying it you know, to an entirely different context overseas. And of course, I mean, we as people do that. We understand things through our own lens, you know, and so these kind of feminist tropes that women need to, you know, for women to be free, it means they have to work, they have to have equal pay, they have to have this, you know, these Western-based kind of notions of what freedom and feminism is, they get transferred to, in this case, Iran. And then later you see how they get kind of transferred to how we think about why Muslim women are oppressed, you know, across all the incredibly varied contexts and places that Muslims live all over the world.
Yeah. So, you know, you tell all these amazing stories in the book, and it's such a wide array of experience, and that's why the stories in the book are so fascinating. And then framing it all in the U.S. context, you tie in the novelist Toni Morrison. And as an English teacher, I can't overlook this. And you tie in her notion of safe harbor from the novel Sula. So what is this concept, and why did you tie it into this book about Islam in America with women of color? And why did you like it? Because it's so gracefully done.
Oh, thank you so much. I mean, first of all, Toni, I mean, you said you're a teacher, and Toni Morrison's just, you know, one of the greatest writers, if not the greatest writers.
It's possible, yeah.
In American letters, right? And so I kind of looked to Toni Morrison for so much. I mean, her novels teach us so much, not just about beautiful writing and the stories and the people, but about history. I mean, it's theory, it's theoretical, it provokes us, it's spiritual, it's religious. There's so much in her writing. But that concept of the safe harbor really struck me as something that was so generative and useful for me for thinking about women's religious spaces, right? And not just Muslim women, but in particular Muslim women, and in particular African-American Muslim women, because of, like I said, the external factors that they always have to contend with in order to be Muslim. So in the novel Sula, there's this scene in which Sula and her friend Nell, they're two little, you know, African-American girls, and they've had, you know, really difficult lives and histories of abuse and different, you know, dangers and violences always in their lives. And there's a moment in which they're just digging in the dirt together, and they both have sticks and they're just poking in the dirt. And Morrison describes how there's a moment in which they just stop speaking. They don't even have to talk. They don't have to communicate. They just kind of understand the ways in which their sticks are going and that they're digging, that they are together and they completely understand each other, and there's no need for them to have to explain who they are to each other. And this is their safe harbor. Mm-hmm. This is this space in which they could completely be themselves, right? And so that for me was a really evocative image to think about the ways in which women, and in particular, working class Black women, right, in the early 20th century. And then, you know, I take the concept onward, would find connection in engaging with a religion that was, on the one hand, telling them, look, you are all equal in the eyes of God. Women are to be respected in this religion, right? And giving them this honor that they felt they had been stripped of, because of the horrors of racism, sexual violence, you know, working in really difficult environments all the time. But then having this space in which they were actually trying to construct a new spiritual world together where it hadn't been done. And that really, since there were no such thing as kind of established Muslim communities or, you know, places in which people actually knew who they were, they could only find that comfort and solace in each other's company, because they were the only ones who actually understood, right, what the other person might be thinking or feeling. And I saw this in my research as well, you know, kind of engaging with older Muslim women who are now in their 70s and 80s and even 90s, right, talking about the ways in which nobody really understood what they were trying to do except their other sisters in Islam. And so that concept of the safe harbor, I think, persists. This, you know, you see it online with Muslim women, you know, creating Facebook groups, or there's this, a mosque now in Los Angeles, the Women's Mosque, in which it's a women's only mosque, or, you know, just creating these spaces in which women, Muslim women of different racial and ethnic backgrounds, generations, etc., can just be themselves.
Mm-hmm. You know, and I get that sense of safe harbor as well, tying back to the very beginning of this conversation when we talked about you and Maya at the farm, Soulflower Farm.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of feel like that almost might be a safe harbor for her and for you whenever you're able to visit. And, you know, it's just kind of joyful because so many of the topics that we have talked about have been really amazing and also could be seen by many people in the world as like really negative. And there's so much like to unpack in the news and in the media with regards to Islam in America. But there's so much positive as well. And can you talk a little bit more about, or a little bit about how Muslims in the U.S. are engaging in amazing things? Like you talk a lot about environmentalism, urban farming, food movements, and then more things that extend these amazing legacies of the women that you profile in the book, as well as this notion of safe harbor.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would love to just start with this, you know, really, like I said, I'm so glad you opened our conversation with that, you know, with the last chapter, with the epilogue of my book, because that's where I'm thinking now, like what I'm interested in. And, you know, as someone who has always been drawn to religious and spiritual sensibilities, you know, what I'm really interested in is the way in which these types of frameworks, Islam or Sufism or whatever, you know, your spiritual orientation is able to build communities in which you can be safe, you know, find a safe harbor, but then you don't stay in that space. You use that human connection that you find in that space to expand. And that's what I feel like a place like Soulflower Farm, Maya Blow's farm in the Bay Area is. Like she came to this as a person of faith and started this farm. And there are, you know, numerous other Muslim women and Muslims in general and people of faith who are starting these types of spaces, farming cooperatives, urban gardens, things like that. Because there is something so inherently spiritual about connecting with the earth and then doing things like growing food and creating, you know, spaces in which people can come and gather and watch things grow, right? And so I feel as if Muslims and, you know, like, again, like I said, other faith-based communities are really engaged in doing this. My sense on the ground doing research for my next project is that it is on everybody's mind, you know, within the Muslim community. And I think, you know, beyond that, there needs to be a way in which we are healing the earth and doing so through the social justice paradigms that have, you know, impelled people to come together in this country. You know, the civil rights movement, the Black Power movement, all these types of racial justice struggles, all of these are merging together right now. And so I see that happening a lot. I see young people really engaged in it. I see people thinking about it, trying to figure out, you know, how to challenge these, you know, systems that they feel are making life more and more difficult for future generations every day. And then your other question was about what other things people are doing.
Well, that's fine, you know, because I feel like you're going to tell those stories, aren't you?
I'm hoping to. I mean, right now where I'm at is, you know, I feel as if it was and it is really important. There's so much more history to tell about Islam. I mean, I feel like I just told a few. I mean, every day I find more stories that I say, oh, gosh, someone needs to tell this story, you know. But I'm also interested in the ways in which that impulse of Islam in the United States, like I said, you know, early Muslims, African-American Muslims, and I think now a new generation of Muslims is kind of learning, like, this thing called Islam in the United States is not what, you know, everyone's telling us it is. And if we actually go back and do our homework and we look at the ways in which people have engaged and mobilized and found community and safety around these types of community and religious spaces, we can grow something and reach out and create something really beautiful. And so, I'm really interested in that right now, and I'm really interested in how Islam and Muslims are finding new points of coalition with other groups and doing things like, you know, responding to climate crisis and engaging with Black Lives Matter and engaging with, you know, the Me Too movement, you know, because that's where the new generation is. This is a generation that's never known anything besides a post 9/11 world. And what my students tell me is that they're tired of it. They want to make something brand new in which, you know, they get to say who they are. They're tired of other people telling them, you know, who they are and aren't. They want to define that themselves.
Well, Dr. Sylvia Chan Malik, this has been wonderful. I appreciate your time so much. And I look forward to some future conversations with you and following your work in the future.
That would be great. Thank you so much. It was lovely.
Classical Ideas is produced by me, Greg Soden. Music on Classical Ideas is composed and performed by Derek Strybing. You can find his music at www.wearewarmmusic.com. If you like this show, please rate it on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can email me at classicalideas@outlook.com or find me on Patreon at patreon.com/classicalideaspodcast. Thanks so much for listening.